Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm.
Well, hello everybody. Happy Earth Day. Hope everybody is having a fantastic day. Happy Tuesday night. Welcome to the live show. We're getting ready for a short stint on the road for work, things like that. So we'll have some fully pre-recorded episodes coming up here soon with some great guests, some great topics. As always, even though we do pre-recorded stuff whenever I'm on the road, it's always new content. We have never in the history of this show or our previous incarnation done a replay episode or a greatest hits episode or anything of that nature. It's always been new content. So we will have all kinds of new stuff coming up for you. Our guests tonight in the second part, which is always our pre-recorded guest. No matter if we're on the road or not, it's always a pre-recorded guest. Our second guest tonight is Dr. John Hall. We will be talking about targeted individuals, targeting technologies, specifically some of the ways that we were targeted during the pandemic with different technologies. So we will be talking about that in our second part. In our first part, we are joined. You couldn't get better on Earth Day than to have an actual nature journalist on the show. So our guest in the second part, or in the first part, is our good friend Chester Moore from Higher Calling Wildlife, as well as Gulf Great White Sharks, and the Dark Outdoors podcast, which is what we're having him on about tonight, specifically the Texarkana Moonlight Murders. This is a series of murders that really led into all kinds of things in the world of serial killer. I think it was one of the cases that actually led to the term serial killer. But welcome back to the show, Chester. How have you been, my friend?
Man, I'm doing great. And we were talking before we came on, just a lot of good projects, a lot of positive things. And you mentioned Earth Day and working on some stuff with great white sharks. You can go to gulfgreatwhites.com, my blog, a lot of cool stuff. We're doing a giveaway there of a cool decal that I have.
Nice.
But a lot of great things. And I'm speaking at the Falcon Monster Festival this weekend. Tickets still available for that event at the Friday night dinner. And you mentioned it. I'm talking about the Moonlight Murders, the Texarkana Phantom Killer, made famous by the 1970s Charles B. Pierce film, The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah, and you like me are a fan of classic horror, things like that. And this was one of those movies that I remember seeing probably mid high school, something like that.
It was a movie that, you know, actually before I ever had the guts to actually watch a slasher movie when I was about, I probably started at the end of between third and fourth grade, I'd watched like the Universal Monsters,
yeah,
Vincent Price movies. But I was a little scared of the slasher stuff. I went to a video club and they had a VHS of Town That Dreaded Sundown. And I almost rented it in third grade. And I turned around and there's like the shot of the Phantom going through the screen at the Stark House and the thing. And it looked too freaky, so I put it down. And then a couple of years later, after I kind of ponied up and got the guts to watch slasher movies, it blew me away. It's very well made. If you took the humor parts out that a lot of people don't realize, Charles B. Pierce, who was the man who brought us The Legend of Boggy Creek, also brought us A Town That Dreaded Sundown.
That's right. And
so Charles B. Pierce is Sparkplug, the goofy deputy in the movie. And his daughter, Pamela, told me that he kind of created that character at the time to kind of offset the extreme violence. If you like took his parts out, you would have the perfect slasher movie. Still a great one. And even his parts are fun. But a guy named Bud Davis played the Phantom. And I've got to, before we get into the dark, weird, scary stuff, I have to share a funny story about this. So back when red-blooded American males used to take vehicles out with their girlfriends and go park somewhere to make out, you know, back in that era of time, me and my girlfriend went to go parking at this spot that I located by these woods over by, before, this is before I had dark outdoors, by the woods over by this old abandoned boat ramp, right? And so we pull up there, and by the way, this is my wife, Lisa, now. We got married, so it's okay. And we literally get there. I turn the car lights off, kind of look around, don't see anything. I unbuckle my seatbelt. She unbuckles her seatbelt. I turn. I literally just like a peck of a kiss starts, and I hear boom, boom, boom on the windshield. Do you know what my first thought was? God's honest truth. The freaking Phantom from Texarkana. There's going to be a guy with a white sack on his head,
right,
a flashlight and a pistol wanting me to get out. And I turn around and I was relieved that it was a cop.
Right.
And I roll the window down. I'm like, hello, sir. And he's like, he's laughing. He goes, you guys seem like some good kids. Why don't y'all go out and go talk somewhere else? And we went home and talked, because I tell you what, Chris, that killed the mood.
Go talk.
That killed the mood, brother.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And, you know, once again, the idea, I've told numerous people, especially recently, there's been quite a bit of talk with some people that I know about dark outdoors and things like that. And just the idea that, you know, a seasoned journalist like yourself who deals with wildlife photography is out in Yellowstone more than a few times a year, things like that, filming things like bighorn sheep relocation, that kind of stuff. To know that you're hosting a show like this, that it's one of those, it is a cautionary tale show.
Yeah.
And one of those, like, enjoy the outdoors, but don't forget to be safe.
You're the first person who brought me on another media outlet to talk about dark outdoors, because you get it. And it came from experience.
Yeah.
It came from running into shady characters in dark places and being chased off of a mountain with my dad in Northern California back in 2002 by what the U.S. Forest Service told us were absolutely drug runners. And, you know, asking people if they ever had anything mysterious or dangerous happen, and then having them tell me all these stories. And so I want people to have a good time in the outdoors. So what I tell them is dark outdoors is shining light on these topics.
Yeah.
And it's a positive program, but it's also got a campfire tale quality as well, because I'm a storyteller. And you can subscribe to Dark Outdoors on any major podcasting platform, or on iHeartRadio, Spotify, Audible, et cetera. It's an award-winning program. It's been awarded by the Press Club of Southeast Texas on a couple of occasions, and got an episode up about the real story of Jaws. And if you go way back in the archives, like episode 2 or 3, we have a Phantom Killer episode on that. So if you're into this topic, scroll down and go do a deep dive. You'll find that episode. But, you know, what's interesting, Chris, you mentioned like Yellowstone and being out in real wilderness, which I have the privilege of getting to do multiple times a year. But in this journey, I literally took it as a journalist. I had no preconceived notions. I'm going to pursue a story and see what's out there, you know?
Yeah.
And what I found was that the most dangerous spots are areas that are nature centers or lovers lanes or big green belt areas fairly close to an urban center. People think they're safe because they're out of the city.
Yeah.
Yet some of the criminals from the city use this as an advantage to go into some of these areas. And really, the Texarkana Phantom was the first example I can think of that. I mean, this guy, and we'll talk more about the link to the Zodiac Killer here shortly, was doing that kind of stuff and using those exact kind of areas to attack people. And, you know, it all started on a moonlit night, February 22nd, 1948. Jimmy Hollis, he was 25, and his 19-year-old girlfriend, Mary LeRae, They were attacked on a lover's lane, and they survived. He blacked out. He was pistol whipped almost to death. She was brutalized in every way you can think of. But she described a man in an average, decent, like probably like my size, 6 foot tall or so, decent sized guy with a white hood with eyes cut out. And I think the mouth cut out as well in the real Phantom. And had a flashlight and a gun, and a very deranged individual. And they lived. And he never got to really tell much of his part because he was so, I mean, he got just pistol whipped to death. But just less than a month, a little over a month later, Richard Griffin, who was 29, and Polly Ann Moore, 17, quiet road on the outskirts of town, found shot to death in Griffin's car. And then they were placed outside the car. And then the moonlight murders begin. And it was the same exact kind of pattern. They knew they had something very serious going on here with a killer who was striking in a pattern. And it was like the first time just whet his appetite. The second time he goes all the way through and literally strikes fear into the community around Texarkana, both on the Texas and the Arkansas side.
And as at once again, that small rural communities like that had even major cities like that at the time had not really seen a murder series like this. I mean, there were cases, H.H. Holmes, things like that back in the 1800s, that kind of stuff. But
Jack the Ripper, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. But they were isolated at best, and they didn't really, once again, fall into something like this where people were being stalked in such a way.
Yeah. And what was interesting about this is the fact that this guy had obviously scoped these areas or knew this general area well enough to think, okay, they're going to be, I'm going to go check this area out or be waiting in this area because someone's going to come parking on a Saturday night or, you know, we're going to know this area and have a familiarity with the spot enough to do these things in an area and feel like they could get away with it. And, FBI files. I'm doing a special. I only got 20 of them printed up. Phantom Texarkana gift package this weekend. It's got some of my favorite clips from the FBI files on that.
Oh, wow.
And when it really went crazy was on April 14th, 1946. And that was an Easter Sunday when Paul Martin, 17, and Betty Jo Booker, 15, were found in Spring Lake Park. He was shot four times. And Booker's body was found 2 miles away and shot twice. She'd been playing saxophone at a school event. They left after like the school dance or whatever. And they found him, you know, out there. And he'd obviously taken the woman far away. But interestingly, the one that survived, she said he told her to run. So this sicko told the woman to start, the young girl to run. And he got off on chasing her and stuff. And there seemed to be an element of that. And when this one happened, it was like everybody freaked out. The gun stores were sold out. You know, the hardware store was sold out of locks. The movie calls it The Town That Dreaded Sundown. And you brought up a great point, as you always do, Chris, about this being the first one the public was kind of conscious of like this. This is when print media ruled and the radio ruled. And it was on every major radio news station. It was in it was in magazines like, you know, Time magazine. Then it was in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, it was a national phenomenon that there was a killer stalking people on lovers' lanes in quiet little Texarkana, in a remote area, really at that time of the Texas-Arkansas border, and it got attention. And what struck me to want to investigate this thing is I realized this was the first time a killer could walk the streets and walk by a newspaper stand and see his work terrorizing a community right in front of his eyes. He could be listening to the radio and hearing about his work and creating terror beyond just the murders and the impact of the families, but in an entire community and striking fear. And I think that's what emboldened the guy. I think that's why the Phantom Killer seemed to get a little bit bolder, and because he knew all of a sudden he was an icon. And probably the biggest mistake was the newspaper to label him the Phantom. I think a police officer first said he's like a phantom because we can't find him. And then all of a sudden it went from being a regular person to almost a mythical type figure. And it just kind of lived on with the Phantom Killer. And so at this point, he's attacked 6 people, killed 4. And then an interesting attack happened on May the 3rd, 1948. Virgil Starks, age 37, and Katie Starks, 36, were attacked at their farmhouse. He was shot through a window and killed. And then she was shot twice in the mouth. And she managed to get out of the house and escape. And in the town that dreaded sundown, this is the scene where Don Wells, who was Marianne in Gilligan's Island, does an incredible role here. Yeah. This terrified woman being stalked through a cornfield after he comes. And she finally gets kind of what really happened, really got over to a house. And, you know, at first, they weren't sure if that was a phantom killing because it kind of broke the pattern. But there were certain things about it that was kind of the MO as well. And it was almost like a new area had been invaded. It was secluded, so that fit. It wasn't a lover's lane, but it was a couple being attacked as well. Still a couple. It was a married couple and their home, and kind of a new part of this is this boldness of the Phantom Killer.
Well, and precisely the idea of invading that space. Once again, this is really the first time that specifically outdoor areas had been targeted, where people would go for seclusion, stuff like that. Once again, lovers' lanes, dead-end roads, that kind of stuff. But the idea that somebody would specifically target that, lie in wait, once again, like you said, very, very akin to some of the killings from the Zodiac Killer, where he basically used public parks, things like that, places that people would go at night for seclusion.
Well, here's what I think happened. I'm actually working on a book about this. My Great White Shark documentary has taken too much of my year up for me to complete the book this year, so it'll be 2026 on the book.
Good for you.
But thank you. But I do believe the pattern created and the media sensation created by the Phantom of Texarkana is what spawned the Zodiac Killer. It spawned a lot of other of these kind of, you never heard of Lover's Lane's killings before. And they've happened all around the nation. And I really do believe that this is, I call it the Phantom Legacy, what spawned afterwards. Now, I want to get into that in a minute, but in the months after this is, you know, they had it was a huge investigation. They sent Texas Ranger in to stay in the area. And, you know, and this Texas Ranger, a lot of the local cops and stuff weren't a big fan of him. They said he was more of a showboat, but Texas Rangers were involved. A lot of law enforcement. If you look at the FBI files, you can see there were literally hundreds of fingerprints and things sent in for comparison. And they were able to use, even back in 1946, technology to find out that these particular bullets were fired out of the same, you know, gun and everything, which is really interesting. But one of the law enforcement officers noticed that on one of the nights of a killing, the same weekend, there was an abandoned stolen car left in the general area. And he thought, and there's a theory, and this is in the town of Dreaded Sundown as well, but they don't go into this part, but they mentioned the stolen car thing, that this person might be a car thief as well. So they really started ramping up on that, and they ended up arresting a guy named Yule Sweeney. And Yule Sweeney was 29 years old. He had a young wife. I think she was like 18 or 19 at the time. And when they arrested him, he evaded arrest. He said, "You're not just pulling me over for stealing a car. It's a lot worse than that." And he never they immediately put him in the lump, you know, the possibility of a phantom guy. But his guy was into everything. He was in he had all kind of stuff going on. But Yul Sweeney never confessed, but his wife confessed that she saw some of the murders and that he was the Phantom Killer. And there was some law or something at the time about like wife's confession, all kind of weird stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also she ended up recanting her confessions. So they couldn't get him on it. And by the way, here is a photo I have here.
Oh, wow.
He's in the middle right there. And that guy right there is Yul Sweeney. It's like a bunch of hunters went out and bagged a trophy buck. They got the Phantom right in their mind. Wow. These guys were like, hey, we got the guy. Because they really thought it was him. And that's Yul Sweeney right there in the middle. And he was the chief suspect. And what was interesting about it, Chris, is that they were so convinced it was him, they went and looked at a Texas law on car thievery. And at the time, there was a law that if you had stolen 3 cars, you could be put up for life for that. So they went and looked and stuff, and they put him away for life for stealing cars, thinking we can't say he's the Phantom Killer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We believe he's the Phantom, and there's a law that he's guilty for this anyway. We're going to put this guy away. Now, the killings had stopped. They had stopped before they actually caught the guy anyway.
Okay.
You know, these guys always kill exactly in succession. They may think that there's too much law enforcement, whatever. They may go underground, move to a different area, you know. But they really believe Yul Sweeney was. And Pamela Pierce, who is the daughter of Charles B. Pierce, told me on a Dark Outdoors podcast that her dad carried this picture in his wallet after he did the movie and showed him that's what the Phantom looks like.
Wow.
And because if you can't see here, but the eyes are real, like, intense-looking eyes. And I thought that was interesting, you know, that they did have a suspect. And there's a couple of great books about the topic. My take is what I really want to go into next about the legacy part of this. But there's another guy. I had John Tennyson on my program. And John Tennyson is a medical doctor and a clinical psychiatrist. And he is the first cousin once removed of the second main suspect that people don't know a lot about.
Okay.
This guy. The H.B. Duty Tennyson, who kind of looks like a younger Andy Quaid here, kind of look like to me.
Right.
But H.B. Duty Tennyson. And the reason he was a suspect, and you can hear a lot of this on that episode, was because he went to college. He would have been 16 at the time of the killings, but he was a pretty tall guy, very intelligent. There have definitely been young people involved in serial killings and stuff before. But there's some interesting connections. He ended up killing himself and left a suicide note. And the guy didn't just kill himself. He killed himself by going and buying cyanide, which you could buy at the time, and killing himself with cyanide. Yeah, he did it. That's a good article. You got to read it. Tennyson did that. Very interesting stuff. Really, really interesting. He does an incredible job. He's a very intelligent man, of course, being a doctor of both practices there. But in the suicide note, he doesn't say specifically that he killed all of them. But he mentioned one pair. I forget which one it is now. And he mentioned Mr. Starks. And he said, if you had done what I had done, you would have wanted to die too. Now, according to Mr. Tennyson, that there are experts on suicide notes in the field of psychiatry. And that according to him, he talked to like the leading guy on the suicide notes and suicidology. And as far as we know, in the history of known suicide letters, there's never been a false confession of murder. It would be the first known.
Interesting.
So that's interesting.
Yeah.
But we know what interested me more about him, Tennyson, is that Tennyson actually knew most of the people who were killed.
Really?
Yes. He lived in a house that was a duplex at one point, and the Starks family were over there all the time. He knew Mrs. Starks, Mr. Starks. He went to school with a couple of the girls that were attacked. And he worked the cinema the night the first couple was attacked where they went.
Wow.
So a lot of really, really interesting connections to Duty Tennyson. You know, if I were to just blindly look at it from what we know about most modern serial killer types, I would probably go with Yul Sweeney because he's a little bit older. He was involved in, and a lot of these serial killers are involved in other crimes as well.
Sure.
He was involved in a lot of other stuff. He was older, be more experienced, but it's hard to deny the connections to the victims of Duty Tennyson. And John Tennyson's article, if you're interested in this, please go read Did Duty Do It? Incredible, great stuff. You can listen to him on my podcast as well. And I was greatly appreciative of someone with that close of a connection being on Dark Outdoors to talk about that. So thank you, John Tennyson. But it's a fascinating case because it was never officially solved. And that's a tough thing, I know, for law enforcement, you know, to have that. And of course, even tougher thing for the families.
Now, what was it, the case that all of the bullets throughout the investigations, everything, did guns match up, all that kind of stuff? There were no copycats during the series of killings.
The only thing was, it was, I believe, a .22 was used for the Stark house. But in my opinion, that might have been a rifle because of the accuracy of the shooting through the window and things like that. I can't imagine someone being accurate enough to take a .22 pistol through a window at a distance and hitting a woman across the room. I could see hitting the guy who was kind of like in my position, like the Phantom would have been here in the window shooting from behind.
Yeah.
It could have been a rifle. But this is really, there's so many connections that go to the Zodiac Killer. One of them is that the Zodiac Killer had a very similar caliber weapon, had the mask, and he left a couple alive.
Yeah.
That's important because I think the Phantom left that girl alive to tell what he looked like, the mask.
Yeah.
If you want to strike fear, that mask creates fear. And now the Zodiac would definitely have heard about this. Now, there are entire people with entire whole Zodiac Killer, their whole life's based around who the Zodiac Killer is.
Yeah.
I have a suspect I think is a Zodiac Killer. And I think the guy that I think is a Zodiac Killer, he's the most controversial. Yeah, there's the picture with the Zodiac and all that. The most controversial because the guy who wrote the book on him kind of linked into too much stuff later on. But there's a guy. So when the Zodiac, that drawing was from a guy who survived the attack at Lake Berryessa.
Yeah.
Okay. And the Zodiac came out and spoke to them and said he had escaped from Deer Lodge prison in Montana. He had been in a prison riot and they had killed a prison guard and he fled to Mexico. So they were immediately thinking, who just escaped from Deer Lodge prison? What they didn't know, there was a guy that just got out of Leavenworth prison who 10 years before had escaped Deer Lodge prison, was in a prison riot where one of the guards was killed and fled. And in 1960, was the most wanted man on the FBI's list for a Lover's Lane murder in Oregon. And
wow,
what was amazing about this is he had a bullet hole in his freaking ear. And when they went to the car, the friends of this couple said the young guy always had a .22 pistol under his seat. And there was a bullet hole shot from within the car out. And this guy has a bullet wound. He ended up getting someone to call for him when he made his phone call. Somebody called, vouch. He gets out and he's on the lam and he's out running around the country again, right? A Lover's Lane murderer. And this guy's name is Edward Wayne Edwards. And there are several good Zodiac candidates. but I'm going to give my conspiracy theory part of this. And that is, they will never pin it on Edwards. Never. And the reason they, if they ever pinned on Edwards, Edwards was living in Atlanta at the time of the Atlanta child killings. And at the time of the Atlanta child killings, this was found through the Freedom of Information Act. The Zodiac killer was writing letters to the police.
Yep.
In Atlanta, claiming to be killing. They didn't release it at the time. They didn't want to scare everybody like they did in San Francisco. And he was living in Atlanta and was arrested, living with a relative. He had stolen a police officer's uniform and tried to burn a house down. And the African Americans around the time were saying there's a white police officer approaching kids. And then all the murders were pinned on a guy named Wayne Williams, who probably maybe killed the two young adults that he was involved with, but they pinned every murder on him. Anyway, rabbit hole. But the only Zodiac suspect who's a known Lovers Lane killer is Ed Edwards, because they got Ed Edwards on. What happened was he killed a couple in 1976, another couple in 1980. And then he adopted a young man when he was 66 years old, who was 18 and kind of a special needs guy who joined the Army, got him to change his name to Edwards. He bought life insurance, let him spend a year in the military, came home and killed him and buried the body. Then it found and called the cops and tipped it off and collected $250,000 in life insurance. When he was 66 years old, he beheaded a guy.
Oh, wow.
What happened was his daughter saw a TV special. You know, like they'll do a TV special about like an unsolved murder from 30 years ago.
Yep.
And she goes, "That was my dad. I know it. He took it to the scene." So they went and got the guy, and they pulled DNA and it was him. But he wanted the death penalty, and if that state did not have the death penalty, he said, "Well, does like this other state?" And he said, "Yeah, but they tricked him, because the year he did it, there was no death penalty. You can't be for that year." And so they linked him with DNA and everything to another Lovers Lane murder. It's four people we know he's killed now. And then he finally confessed to killing his adopted son for the death penalty. So we know he's killed five serial killer. The only Zodiac person who's a known serial killer of people on Lovers Lanes who happen to be in Deer Lodge prison. But the crazier part, and really this goes back to the Phantom. This is where I kind of link all this together.
Sure.
Media loving criminals, which we saw really happen in the 70s after Zodiac, it went crazy, right?
Yep.
This guy wrote a book, how he was a reform, 1972, published a book, how he was a reformed criminal. And he was traveling the country speaking at, like, you know, Lions clubs and churches, but he's a reformed guy. And he told all these criminal, all his criminal stories. He talks about being at the scene of the Lovers Lane murder in the book in 1960, which he did. There's no doubt about that. The guy did it. He was found at the scene by the police, right? And then he gets on TV, and there was a show called To Tell the Truth.
Yep.
He was on To Tell the Truth. It's on YouTube. When Alan Alda from MASH was one of the guests. And they're saying, this man was in, you know, that voice back in the day.
Yeah.
This man in 1960 was the most wanted man for a double murder and blah, blah, blah. And they had these three people, and there he is in front of the world.
What?
And the murders he was, the murders we know he did were like 3 to 8 years after he was on TV. This guy's traveling the country killing people, talking about being reformed. What was the Zodiac killer? A writer, right? Mm. And by the way, the Zodiac cipher was 13 letters. Edward Edwards is 13 letters. A lot of things like that. But where it all joined together was this. At the same time, the word serial killer kind of came into our vernacular.
Yeah.
You had the Phantom, you had the Zodiac, and then you had really with right in a row, you had Ted Bundy start up.
Yep, John Wayne Gacy.
Gacy start up.
Yeah.
And these guys were everywhere in the media, and they got to watch their crimes terrorize people.
Now,
so, like, their killing was magnified.
The interesting, especially about the media coverage part, the first two, the Phantom Killer, those happened basically in real time. Dahmer, even though things and disappearances were happening in real time and there may have been some slight media coverage, it's not like they were actively searching for a serial killer in the news, things like that, when they found him.
No.
You know? But, same thing, no, with, Dahmer, same thing, like, basically, but, with John Wayne Gacy.
But Ted Bundy had escaped from prison.
Yeah.
Twice. And was on the lam killing people. He runs to Florida.
Yep.
And then the closest thing to a real slasher movie ever was him in the sorority house.
Yeah.
He killed these women all in one night in a sorority house. So he's running the country, escaping prison. And his stories have been everywhere for years about these weird murders and what happened to this lady. And so these guys kind of puffed themselves up. And, because Gacy and Bundy were in the 70s, but the one that I think that really took the media coverage for the first time to the zenith was the Night Stalker.
Mm. Yeah.
He had those weird chicks that were hanging out wanting to marry him in the courtroom.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
You know, just a cautionary tale, ladies. I'm not a marital advice person. Don't go for the serial killers. That might be weird. You know, don't go for the serial killers.
But
he basked in it. But he was watching himself in the news. But the irony of it was he had went to Arizona and came back on a bus. And they had the artist rendering. And he goes to the bus station, and this is in like 84, 85, when everybody was reading the LA Times. And there's his picture on the frickin' LA Times, and he's walking by looking at people, looking at him. And there literally was a mob that chased him down, almost killed him, and caught the Night Stalker.
Wow.
But in the – people don't know about that part. It was crazy. But in the press, in the courtroom part – he was all puffed up. You know, he was doing the devil horn sign, going in the courtroom. I mean, he really took that media almost like a platform for his evil to continue. And that was interesting. I call this the Phantom's legacy of creating a media sensation by killings. And maybe he didn't design it that way, but he saw it happening.
Yeah.
And then all these other killers are, you know, they're getting off on it.
Well, and to use the media as part of your fear tool. Things like that, especially in a small rural town, that kind of stuff. Yeah. That's definitely a thing. And Zodiac is really one of the first ones where police, because of the media attention, really started seeing copycats call in. False reports coming in, things like that. People reporting that they were the Zodiac killer. All kinds of stuff to the point where they started feeding false information to the media.
Yeah, because Zodiac was writing letters and they were publishing these letters in the newspaper, right?
Yeah.
And people were like engaged with them. And you're right, there were all these false things. It became a whole different. It made investigations a lot harder because now you had 20 Zodiacs.
Yeah,
you know, you had all these people plus the list you might be actually looking at. Well, and then you go these other, like your Night Stalker and these different ones like that were going out terrorizing people for a long time. People knew, like, the Dahmer stuff, they just, like, people were missing. And then they found him in his fridge. When it come to the Night Stalker, he was breaking in and raping and terrorizing people, little girls and everything else, you know. And just a monster of a person. And so you had a lot of that going on. And but I think what's happened now is there's a killer. Well, I do believe in innocent till proven guilty, no matter how politically incorrect it is.
Yes.
But the guy they have charged with the Long Island serial killer, Rex Huerman, in Long Island, in New York, they got a massive case against this guy. And if they prove all this, and this DA has been very smart and strategic with this guy, this could be bigger than Bundy. In terms of impact. And, you know, Chris, you were the first person to ever take me on a media platform and ask me about the smiley face killer's connections, maybe to the Lady Bird Lake deaths.
Yeah.
And I've been studying not so much Lady Bird Lake deaths, but these kind of like public killings and modern things. And kind of something that's really struck me lately is technology is and media has created a new kind of killer, a smarter killer.
Yep.
Ones that know how to back engineer the perfect kill because they watch all the shows. They can buy the forensic books.
Yeah.
They study investigations. And when and Rex Schuerman, this guy, they found a list. So this guy wasn't some, you know, homeless guy who had an addiction issue other than killing. This guy, and I'm not belittling those people, but he wasn't just some rogue guy out there. This guy was a Manhattan architect. Okay. Huge contracts, right? A businessman, respected businessman. And they found a list of his evaluation of his killings and how he can do it better and how to make fewer mistakes, even down to stuff like attack smaller women because they're easier to deal with.
Yeah.
I mean, like, so I think what's being born, and I think what scares me more than anything, is that we are seeing the birth of a new kind of killer that's able to see their killings terrorize, but their anonymity remain intact because of how they use the system to evade being captured. I guarantee you there are multiple serial killers somewhere out there using AI to find ways to evade capture.
Interesting. And
cheating the system somehow, finding ways to get around it. And it's a modern kind of terror where their acts live on, but they don't want to see their face seen. They want to keep doing this stuff, you know? And they're not, some of them aren't as unhinged as a Bundy maybe. Now they're just as evil. And I have no problem using that word.
Sure.
They're evil.
No, if you're going to stalk human beings, things like that, to that kind of extent, I'm not one period. People, well, period.
He was attacked by the bear at the zoo as a child. I don't care. He shouldn't be slashing people and putting them in his basement, right?
Yeah.
But I think there's the kind that's the methodical kind now. And I think this Rex Schuerman guy is the next level of that Phantom Legacy, where he was labeled the Long Island serial killer. And I think he's probably going to be found guilty. They got so much against this guy. Is unbelievable. And there's a whole lot more, but the Long Island serial killer was looked for 25 years. And he gets to go in the biggest media market in the world. The biggest media market in the whole world and see all these deaths. And he's making lists of, this guy's making a list of how to be a more efficient killer. I think that's what's being born. I think the idea of addiction to the killing, the killing part being, I'm sure they have some kind of deranged, a lot of sexual reason or whatever, but they love the attention that they are striking fear in a community, in a town, in a state, in a nation. And now they can use tech and back engineer the perfect crime so they can keep doing it for years and years and years.
Well, and the idea of the AI is an interesting concept. We've definitely had the conversation specifically about the smiley face killers and the missing feet that were washing up all over British Columbia, things like that for years. The two concepts that many serial killings of this type may be over the road truckers or traveling workers.
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
I had actually given a buddy of mine who was a horror writer the concept of like a traveling AV technician basically being like an American psycho, where it's like, hey, I hop into town for like 5 days and then I'm gone and I may not be there for like another, I may never even go back to that town again.
That's the thing. They like,
that's a perfect cover.
It's crossing jurisdictional lines.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and what really concerns me also is there were a lot of Lover's Lane attacks for 50 years.
Yeah.
A lot more people attacked in homes. But what's happening now is they know those are areas that are prone to get caught because of. So what they do now is they target prostitutes more than they used to. And a lot of undocumented children. A lot of undocumented people that are in the country, they're undocumented because there's no paper trail.
Yeah.
And Unfortunately, and I think this is a black eye in our culture, a young woman who has a meth addiction who is now selling her body for meth isn't much of a headline. Yeah. When her body's found dumped somewhere. But the cheerleader at the high school would be. And they're both equally tragic, you know?
Yep.
And so these monsters are figuring more ways. Now, there are some they're going to target, and like the smiley face thing is a whole different level.
Well, and that's what we've talked about before, is the idea that perhaps that is an MO that's shared because of its spread across the country. And even the similarity of the killings here at Lady Bird Lake to the smiley face killings, that perhaps it's an MO that's shared across the dark web. Something like that.
I don't think there's any way those deaths are one or two people. I think it's like William Ramsey is the first person I heard to say it, probably a method of operation.
Yeah.
But I do believe now we're coming into the age of an entirely different kind of killer that is seeing their terror strike communities. Yep. But here's the difference, Chris. It's not next day in the newspaper. It's in real time.
Yeah.
It's in real time. Look what I did. Look at that body that was found. You know, these people could be looking and watching as someone finds the body, you know, I mean, and then, you know, it's gotten to that level of legacy. What started back as, you know, this hooded figure killing people and destroying lives in Texarkana gets all this media attention. Zodiac Cops, the same exact thing, adds writing to it.
Yeah.
Terrorize. And then you see these media darlings come along with, and I say media darlings because you and I have a hard time sometimes finding the line on when to talk about some of these people and not. Like, I don't look at serial killers as heroes.
Yeah.
I don't have serial killer trading cards at the house.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But there is a part like where they like the media relishes in the gore of it.
Absolutely.
You know? And so that contributes to this whole thing, you know. And I think Wes Craven tapped into that in the Scream movies.
Well,
very well.
You know what's interesting, to bring that to the Night Stalker, Wes Craven actually believed that the Night Stalker may have been embodied by an egregore that he helped create through Freddy Krueger.
Interesting.
He was like, I think the guy was possibly possessed by something that I helped create.
I've got to look at
because of people's love for Freddy Krueger and things like that.
I would just tell him it's a demon. You didn't create it, but it may be doing the MO.
Yeah.
But that I have no doubt. Yeah. Every single one of these killers is demonically possessed. I mean, this level of depravity is beyond, you know,
the average human.
About that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Cray, you got another rabbit hole. Great. You know, but, you know, what's interesting about that is this idea of media crossing over. He actually did Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
Oh, I love that one. The whole meta concept of that and Freddy breaking out into the real world was so beautiful.
And then Freddy had come alive as that.
Yeah.
So that now what you're saying makes a lot more sense even.
Yep.
He made that in the movie. But going into Scream, and the idea of, you know, a couple of the movies in, they're talking about they did it. Like, he came back for the fourth movie, which is my favorite maybe other than the first one. And the girl was basically killing, and she says, well, how am I supposed to get a bunch of followers?
Yeah.
You know, what am I going to be? I don't have time to get famous. You know, I'm going to be famous. And it's that level of things out there. So that's what
– well.
That, you know, Chris, just one thing I want to get in before I forget.
That's please, okay. go.
Because I am prone to forget stuff. I get on all these trails. I'm a great host with you. But I know if you listen to Dark Outdoors, and please subscribe on all podcasts and platforms. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Chris is my buddy in media, and he's such a great interviewer. But one thing I want to get across is we talk a lot about safety in the outdoors. I talk about everything about, you know, concealed carry to pepper spray to just using your mind the right way and how to look at a situation. But one thing I want everyone out there to think about, men and women right now, be extremely careful who you let into your personal online space.
Yes.
People can get in. We all have social media accounts. But when people are getting too interested in you, too into this, you notice them kind of lurking, be alert of that. Because that's where a lot of these people will end up being we're gonna see that they're coming out of a lot of this and everything. And but it's an interesting time, my friend. And,
You know,
I'm excited to get taught more, a whole lot more details on the Phantom Killings and Falk. And that's Friday night for the dinner. Tickets still available. And you know, it's unsolved. And is it Yul Sweeney? Is it Duty Tennyson? Is it someone else? We'll talk a lot more about both of those people and kind of what's created out there. But it's become a passion of mine to raise awareness of this kind of thing.
Yeah.
To hopefully save lives. It's interesting stuff to investigate. I'm a natural born investigator, so it's really interesting to investigate. And this goes back to my childhood. But to kind of like maybe end the Phantom talk on kind of a funner note, if there is one, you know, absolutely the town that dreaded sundown inspired the Jason Voorhees look.
Yes.
Without question.
Yeah.
Because Jason Voorhees wasn't wearing a hockey mask in the second movie where he was the killer.
That's right.
It was a white sack over his head.
Yep.
And the town that dreaded sundown came out 4 years earlier. And undoubtedly, Sean Cunningham and Steve Miner and all them saw that.
Yeah.
And there's no doubt about it. I mean, even though Michael Myers was made from a William Shatner mask that they painted white.
Yep.
It was still a white mask that came out the year after the town that dreaded sundown. The idea of that white faceless figure, you know, coming out.
Yeah.
So for all you horror buffs out there, the look of the Phantom in the movie, the only thing wrong with that look was he actually had a hole for his mouth, according to the eyewitness, but he did in the movie. It made it scarier. And a couple things in the movie that did not happen. The horrible trombone scene, which is everybody who ever seen the town of dreaded sundown, where he puts the knife on the trombone.
Yeah.
That did not happen, thank God. But there was a lady who, I think it was a saxophone, she was coming from the dance. We mentioned earlier, she was a musician. And they found that's kind of where that Charles Pierce put that in there. But a guy named Bud Davis was the Phantom. In my opinion, as far as a voiceless, he didn't speak in the movie. Killer, if you look at his performance, it's the greatest masked killer performance of all time. He is absolutely terrifying, the intensity he shows in that. And Bud Davis ended up being a mega stuntman who did like Transformers and stuff like that later on. Wow. So just hugely successful later in life. And one of my holy grail autographs from my horror collection, I've always wanted a Bud Davis. And
just have him sign a burlap sack.
Yeah, you know, get a burlap sack sign. Something I'd probably get the poster signed or something like that. But Pamela Pierce was nice enough to send me a picture a couple years ago.
Oh,
her
wow.
father, instead of the movie, had a T-shirt. They had T-shirts done for the cast, and the whole cast signed them. She sent me a screenshot of the Bud Davis signature. He put like a little axe on it.
Nice.
Bud Davis. So I had that little picture. But the guy did a lot of great stuff. Charles B. Pierce, of course, the legend of Boggy Creek.
Yep.
Great, fun movie. That's why we're going to be in Falk, celebrating the Falk monster.
Absolutely.
I'll bring it down to the Texarkana down the road stuff with the Phantom Killer. Talk about some mysteries, some true campfire tales, and hopefully have a good, safe time there in southwestern Arkansas.
Yeah, exactly. And it is a beautiful area. It's always a fun show. There is always a good round of speakers there and a great group of folks that show up.
Yeah,
there,
Craig Woolheat, a great guy, one of the great conference organizers of Cryptozoology, Texas Bigfoot Conference.
Yep.
And I have something I'm starting to do at these Bigfoot locations. I did it last year. I didn't catch any freaking fish, though. Didn't have time. I'm going to fly fish all these Bigfoot locations. So you will see me. I will be in Boggy Creek on the edge of that sometime on Saturday morning before I speak. I'm going to be fly fishing. All of the big, I want to go do it at Bluff Creek.
That's awesome.
All the cool locations. So that's going to be my MO. Fly fishing where Bigfoot dwells.
Yeah, exactly. And, to kind of wrap this, Chester, something I tell my wife regularly whenever she's like, oh my God, the world, I can't believe how horrible the world has become. I'm like, horribly, the world has always been just as horrible. You're just now finding out. Because of our realm of connection. These things have happened locally and colloquially for a long, long time. It's just our realm of connection now that brings the smiley face killers to our front doorstep whenever a case happens. you know, things like that.
It's why I say pray, prepare, and pack heat on dark outdoors.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, even the idea of dark outdoors, the idea that you are there not only demystifying the outdoors, much like we demystify a lot of thick, hard topics here, but to give that word of warning, to give that caveat, because there are so many people out there now, whether it be paranormal, UFO, I mean, hell, there was just a guy in like December, January, we posted an article about a guy in Oregon who went missing and was found dead after a weekend of squatching, you know, went out to his favorite squatch spot and never came back, you know, and that's somewhere that he'd been, all kinds of stuff. So things happen. And the preparation is what's important, and specifically preparing your mind for the fact that things may happen.
Yeah.
You know,
and be prepared.
Be prepared.
You know, I'm a man of faith, and I always say,
be aware.
Prepare, pack heat, and go with your gut. I don't care who you are, how big of a badass you think you are, men listening out there. Okay. You think you can take on King Kong by yourself?
Yeah.
If you got that gut check, I don't care if it's a parking lot or a trail, don't go.
That's right. That's right. Chester, thank you so much for coming back on. Before we let you go, one last time, you're, of course, at the Falk Monster Festival this weekend. But where else can people go to follow you? Where can they go to keep up with all your wildlife work? Where can they go to keep up with the Gulf Coast Great White Project? Where can they go to keep up with Dark Outdoors? Let everybody know where they can go to like, follow, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff.
Thank you, sir. At the Chester Moore on Instagram. That is the Chester Moore on Instagram. Hyacong.net, my wildlife blog, Dark Outdoors on everything from Spotify to Apple Podcasts, Audible, all your major podcast platforms, and my new blog at gulfgreatwhites.com, and lots of stuff centered around wildlife and nature, throwing some true crime in there. And when it crosses over into my boundary of nature and some weird, spooky campfire tales at the same time.
Right. Well, Chester, thank you so much, as always, for coming on. This was a topic that is fascinating to me. And I will definitely get you in touch with that researcher. I don't know if she reached out yet regarding serial killers.
No. We already talked. She was great.
Awesome.
And thank you. And Ono, thank you for being a voice for people who have things to talk about like this. Thank you for your friendship and always being a major supporter. I can't thank you enough, brother.
Thank you. Thank you. Same here, my friend. Take care of yourself. Godspeed. And have fun in Falk this weekend. Tell everybody I said hi.
I will, man.
All right. Take care, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Peace out.
While you are online checking out everything from Chester Moore and HigherCallingWildlife.net, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find our store full of all kinds of music, videos, books from our guests, even classes. That's also where you can get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log, everybody. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend and guest, Dr. John Hall. We will be talking about the Havana Act. We will be talking about Havana Syndrome, targeted individuals, targeting technologies, and some of the things that may have happened to you and your family without your knowledge over the course of the pandemic. We'll be right back, right after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much to Chester Moore. It's always great chatting with him. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you are a user of CBD products like me, stop on by True Hemp Science today. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Christopher Lynch, right here in Austin, Texas, makes an amazing product. Using a spigeric process, he uses every part of the hemp plant, from leaf to bud to stem to roots to seeds. Everything is used, combusted, reused, and that process repeated until nothing remains, providing an amazing full-spectrum CBD product complete with terpene profiles and everything. Stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. That is the website that you want to visit. Curious 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7%. Off your entire cart of $100 or more. Our guest in this segment is Dr. John Hall. He is the author of Guinea Pigs, Technologies and Control, as well as A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America. We have had him on numerous times to discuss the world of targeted individuals, targeting technologies, things like that. Welcome back to the show. Dr. John Hall, how have you been doing?
Hey, Chris, how have you been?
Been doing okay, man. Had a good Easter. It was fun. Got to go out and see a bunch of family I haven't seen in years, so it was good for me. Rest easy, Pope Francis. We'll be talking about popes and prophecies and all that kind of stuff next week, folks. So don't think that we're skipping out on that. But
no, and I'm sure that'll be a great show. Well, I mean, that was a pretty odd or coincidental that, you know, he got out of the hospital just in time to make the Easter service, yeah, and then passed away the day after. Yeah. Sad.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as typical, the communities are a kerfuffle with things and predictions and all kinds of stuff. So, targeted individuals is one of the topics that we champion on this show. It's something that, once I found out about it, once I became aware of your work, it really hit me in a different way. Just the idea that average workaday people, regular people, not necessarily military personnel, anything like that, are targeted by weapons, targeted with things like gang stalking, targeted through other means, to a point where their life is interrupted, their brain function is interrupted. All kinds of things. How did you first become aware of targeted individuals and targeting technologies, Doctor?
Well, I mean, the books all started by the fact that I had a fiance at the time that was being victimized by a private investigative agency here in San Antonio, Texas, that was owned and operated by a former FBI agent and his son, who was a former DOD officer.
Oh, wow.
And we had actually broken up, but she came by my office and she said, "You're the only person I trust to tell this to, but I'm being followed everywhere. Somebody's stalking me everywhere I go, and I'm hearing voices." And I mean, I had known this girl for years, even though we had broken up, we were still friends. So, I mean, I knew that there wasn't a history of mental illness or drug use or anything like that that could be currently, you know, doing it. And sure enough, I kind of, you know, invested in some counter surveillance for her, which is the way I discovered everything I did, along with luckily having some contacts in the CIA. So when I did the counter surveillance on her, we found that there were about 10 different vehicles that were following her during the course of a day. She was being handed off from one stalker to another, and the plate numbers all came back to a particular private investigative service, the one that I told you was actually owned by former FBI.
Yeah.
And so when I, you know, started running their plates, then they started using rental cars, still trying to actually stalk her. And not only stalk her, we're actually breaking into her house and putting Rohypnol, the date rape drug, and drinks and food. Then it wound up turning into being, for the most part, a sexual trafficking case. Men were paying money to come and rape her while she was in an impaired state.
Oh, wow.
So that's what kind of got me into it. We did go to the police, who initially probably didn't believe the story, but luckily I had contacts there too, who basically said, and I, you know, wrote this in the book, they said, when a crazy, every now and again, you come across a story that's so crazy, it has to be true. So that's kind of how we got some of the police investigation going. Unfortunately, what kind of became of it is they basically said, this guy's former FBI, you know, stalking is what he's been trained to do. It's going to be hard to garnish enough proof to actually bring it to a court case. So she changed her name and moved away to get away from some of it, I hope. Yeah, because even I don't, you know where she's at now. And then I decided that to write a book, mostly at the time thinking that I was exposing something that happened here locally in San Antonio. But the first radio show that I did after the book published, was bombarded by about 10,000 emails from around the globe of people describing the exact same thing happening in their countries or their states. So that's kind of what set off the activism. Luckily, through counterintelligence, I was able to discover who was doing it here and was able to at least kind of curtail their operations locally. This particular agency does have field agents pretty much all over the state that are doing this kind of thing in other cities in Texas. One thing that, you know, the people that are targeted, I think it's still at its core experimentation, but the after MK Ultra, you know, resulted in the Church Committee hearings and the CIA got its caught with its hand in the cookie jar. I think with the continuation of MK Ultra, which is exactly what this technology is, I think they decided to farm it out to private investigative companies. That way there's some plausible deniability for the agency. What I've said in the books is it's probably not a CIA agent stalking you or doing the attacking. It's probably a private investigative service that's been allowed to access the technology. I think they're really just interested in the data at the top and not being caught with doing the stalking. Now, that probably isn't the case in whistleblowers. Right now, representing one whistleblower as an expert witness against the Navy, who was found to be implanted. And I think it probably was the Naval Intelligence Service and a combination of the CIA actually attacking him. But in your everyday citizen, I think if you're being experimented on, it's probably being done by a private investigative company that has access to the technology, just like it was done here in San Antonio. And that started, you know, what, 15 years ago now when I wrote about it at first. So the technology's only gotten better over time, and their techniques have only gotten better over time.
Well, and, you know, specifically when it comes to implants, things like that, you know, that is once again, another one that is hard to nail down sometimes. At what point do you get to, I guess, with a case, with a targeted individual, whenever somebody comes to you, at what point do you get to the implant stage?
Well, my personal opinion, and from talking to contacts within the CIA, is that most of this can be done without an implant. Now, if you read my book and you've known me long enough through some of this research, that you know we took groups of individuals and we scanned them for implants and we x-rayed them and we CT'd them and we MRI'd them.
Yeah.
And we did RF scanning on them. And we found some implants. in most of the people, we didn't find implants. So some of it was being done with implants. Some of it was not being done with implants. Now, according to Delgado, before he passed away, he said that all the work he did with implants for the CIA was, you know, was old and archaic, and that everything that he did with implants could be done, as he called it, with broadcasting, you know, meaning that it could be done with over the air radio waves, you know. So that's not to say that there isn't still people being implanted. Obviously, I'm representing a case right now that factually was implanted. We have the device. But that was after years of painstakingly doing RF scans, doing x-rays, doing CTs, doing, you know, high resonance MRIs that can find something as small as a grain of rice. You know, it's really easy to miss something that's a nanoparticle possibly now. I think, you know, 20 years ago when this started, it was a Verichip. Yeah. Was pretty easy to find on x-ray. Now most of these devices are nano and a little harder to find. Now, it's still my kind of thought that most of this is being done without it. Now, I know that some of the people who are really pro nanoparticle say, well, that can be sprayed, or it could be coming from smart dust, or it could be coming from our food, our vaccines. You know, in my mind, if that were the case, logically, we would have a larger population of targeted individuals than we do. You know, then we would, you know, you would think one out of every three people would be complaining of this, and it's just simply not that. So, well, I think most of this is still being done by radio waves without an implant, you know, which kind of explains the way it's done. It usually doesn't start with the hearing voices and the electronic weaponry. It starts with stalking. And the only reason to stalk somebody 24/7, other than to put them in a victim mental state, would be to gather some type of biologics or radiologics on that person, you know, to identify them remotely, you know, perhaps, you know, remotely garnering their EEG, or, you know, finding a pattern of fillings in their mouth that can be, you know, seen, you know, or detected remotely. The reason would be to garner some remote tracking ability on that person. And the EEG or the DNA would be the two ways most likely to do that. And that's where we kind of got into the, you know, the EEG heterodyning that Robert Duncan and I both, you know, kind of, you know, decided a lot of this was.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, God bless Dr. Duncan for his many, many years of work with this. And, you know, like I've got right here an example of what can be used. This is a homemade kit that I bought off eBay, but it is a directional speaker. Like I can direct sound up to 100 feet in distance and a cone of sound probably about 3 feet wide. You know, to be able to literally point at somebody and deliver a message only to them. This kind of technology is used in museums, all kinds of stuff, where you see a piece of art step underneath the light that's in front of it, and you hear the history of the piece of art, things like that. And step out of the light, you don't hear it anymore. So it's
yeah, I've got a similar device to that we used experimentally. That was about the size of a piece of ceiling tile. Mm-hmm. And it, as long as you're under the ceiling tile, you hear ultrasonic sound that is bone conduction through your skull that only you can hear when nobody else around you can. And I know the commercial, for your listeners and your viewers, what you held up that was a DIY is also called audio spotlight commercially.
Yeah. Well, and precisely, you know, these things have been around for a while. I mean, I was in easily junior high, early high school, whenever the first raids in Iraq happened, things like that. But I remember the stories of platoons of soldiers putting their guns down because they heard the voice of Allah in their head tell them to surrender.
And anybody can look that weapon up. That's called S-Quad, Silent Sound Spread Spectrum. And that's a true story. They actually had a bunch of Iraqi soldiers hear Allah telling them to surrender and actually nail down and started disassembling their weapons.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, here's an article right here from Forbes talking about Heat Ray and the Voice of God. My experience with non-lethal weapons eyed for use in DC protests. This is stuff that they use for crowd control, all kinds of things. Even whenever, that was back in the days of Dudes and Beer. Whenever the Naruto run was going to happen on Area 51, that's what I said. I was like, they would not have to fire lethal bullet one.
No.
They have these LRAD systems and everything else already set up. So everybody would be buckled in pain with the voice of God in their head telling them to depart and get away.
Or millimeter wave weapons. Yeah. They would put the active denial system out. And, you know, when your skin is burning, you're going to stop, you know, going that direction.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, and what's funny to bring it back to the Havana syndrome thing is for years, the government has said that microwave weaponry does not exist, things like that. But that's pretty much what they have come to say is the cause of Havana syndrome, as we know it right now, is that immaculate concussion from the vibration of brain matter from something like a microwave weapon.
Well, it depends on who you know, where you get the data. Everybody kind of thought, well, you know, certainly now that it's, you know, agents of their own. And by the way, there's about 1,500 people now complaining of Havana syndrome. It's not a small number of people. And it's not just from Havana. It's people from China, people from DC, people from multiple stations.
Yep.
And Russia. Everybody thought, well, now that their own is being victimized, they'll certainly, you know, come to a conclusion on it or come clean on it. But even then, they actually took their own victims and tried to blame it on crickets. They tried to blame it on permethrin insecticide.
Yep.
They tried to blame it on anxiety and stress. And even as the CIA came out with a report that they sent to Congress that said that, you know, all but a handful of cases could be attributed to work anxiety, which, you know, the Canadian victims are actually suing their government over ignoring their claims. Now, I don't know what's going to happen with the victims here. Most of them are still under a gag order.
Yeah.
There is a couple that are kind of coming to the into the public eye, but it'll be interesting to see what they do. But the CIA is certainly denying that it's any type of microwave weapon from an adversary. But, you know, like we had talked about off camera before, whether they admit it's that they have that kind of weaponry,
yeah,
or if they admit another country has that kind of weaponry, you're admitting that you've got that kind of weaponry. So
pretty much.
Yeah.
We're hard pressed not to be following suit with what our enemies are doing, you know, much like, the space race, things like that. Like we were neck and neck, the whole time. The only thing that separated us was the propaganda. You know.
Well, and if you remember, for your viewers that maybe haven't heard this topic before, if you want to know how far back this goes, Utah State Prison in 1980 had prisoners that were experimented on with this technology and were very clear and concise in their description of it when they said that they were locked in a cell with energy levels in the cell that was so detrimental that most of them couldn't hardly muster the energy to get up off their cots, and that they were hearing voices in their head that were responding appropriately to their thoughts and answers back to those voices asking questions. So, and that was in 82, 85, something like that. And then if you go back to the Branch Davidian case, even Newsweek had it in their magazine that the FBI had contacted Russians to get their technology to put the voice of God into David Koresh's head to get him to surrender.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, there have been means used, but I remember that was the first time that I ever saw, quote, psychic driving in use. I was a senior in high school when that happened. And I guess before that technically was Panama. whenever they were doing basically the same thing that they did at the Koresh compound, which was just 24/7 barraging it with light and just obscene music, you know, yeah. things like that, to basically psychologically break them and cause them to break. And
well, and the
and
only reason they wound up not using the Russian technology was because it wasn't compatible with FBI computers. And that's, just so your listeners know, that's not me thinking that. That's from a Newsweek article at the time, which when was the branch of the Waco Branch Davidian thing? It was 88, something like 89.
Oh, no, no. That was 93.
Oh, was it? No, was that? I was thinking.
Yeah. That was as I graduated high school going into college.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's interesting when you start getting into that, and the fact that, you know, there is no law that prevents the government from experimenting on the public or using an experimental technology publicly. And that's fascinating to think about, especially whenever you look at the fact that there is a Havana Syndrome bill. There are laws. I talk about it all the time whenever I do, whenever I guest on shows, talking about my binaural beat music, things like that. Like there are laws against subliminal messaging, against subliminal messages in movies, television, radio, things like that. And those laws exist because they know it works.
Yep.
Like it's been metrically proven to work, you know, flashing drink Coke, things like that in flash frames of movies, stuff like that. So, the idea that you can take that a step further, the idea that our brain itself is a transducer that is living inside of a resonant chamber known as our skull. You know, it's basically a huge receiving and transmitting antenna. So, like you said, you do not have to have a net of wires attached to your head to get an EEG signal.
That was discovered a long time ago. That was Malik's discovery, that if you basically shoot two dissimilar frequencies into the brain, that each hemisphere will entrain that frequency, create an interference frequency, and that interference frequency gets transmitted. And your EEG can be garnered off of that transmitted interference wave. And then once you have somebody's EEG, that's essentially, we call it a neural fingerprint. You know, every one of our EEGs is different. And, you know, with heterodyning, that's where you actually, simplest terms, is think that you have an encyclopedia of EEG waveforms that correspond to depression, to anger, to violence, to a rapid heartbeat, to a headache, to, you know, a backache. And then you put that back into the person's head where their brain entrains that, then they will display that symptom because the brain is ultimately controls everything in the body.
Yeah. So, yeah. It's, and, you know, horribly, horribly, I will honestly admit it. Whenever I first found binaural beats, whenever I first found those frequencies, things like that, musically, I used them in my experimental music, in the music that I made about like end times and things like that. I would use frequencies that were known to make people uncomfortable and bury them behind the music and things like that to see if it elicited response. So yeah, like it is not horribly impossible to make somebody feel uncomfortable, to make them start a frequency of thought pattern, because once again, like I speak about regularly in shows that I guest on, it's the idea that a frequency is not just a color or a note in the musical scale, or even the flashing of a light. It's your frequency of thought as well. All those things are integrally combined.
So, well, and for people who don't believe that, put an epileptic in front of a flashing light.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you can actually induce seizures. You can induce seizures in someone that's non-epileptic, but,
yes.
You know, a good case in point, I was in Las Vegas for a medical meeting, and we decided to go see Cirque du Soleil. And a lot of flashing lights, a lot of, you know, it was the one, I forget the name of it, but one where they're, it's in mostly in water, waterfalls, and there, yeah, you know, there's a lot of flashing lights off of water. And there was a lady sitting right next to me that had a full grand mal seizure sitting next to me. And I mean, I got her on the ground, I got her controlled, talked to her husband. I said, is your, you know, your wife epileptic? And he goes, no, not that I know of. She's never had a seizure, yeah, but you know, she had a seizure initiated by the flashing lights in that show.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that was quite literally the way that Nostradamus, tune in next week to hear more about Nostradamus, folks. But quite literally how Nostradamus went into his famous trances was a candle in front of a dish of water. And he would tap the water with a quill to make it ripple. And the flashing of the light basically hypnotized him, watching the light flicker inside of the motion of the water, basically put him into a hypnotic state and put him into a trance. So, yeah, I mean, the idea that somebody even, and it doesn't have to be a flashing light that's on the water. It's the fact that the laminar flow of the water is happening at the rate of the brainwave and the light just shimmering off of it does it.
Yeah, and that's also the reason that if any of your viewers have ever had surgery where you're laying on a gurney and you're being wheeled to the OR for any length of time, we usually cover the patient's eyes because the just rolling, yeah, looking and seeing the fluorescent lights of a hospital ceiling,
yeah, the
can
throb
actually
of
actuate,
the, yeah.
Yeah, can, yeah, actuate a seizure in patients. So we're real cautious about that when we wheel somebody that's flat on their back, or we try, if they're conscious, we try to sit them up, you know, at an angle where they're not exposed to the fluorescent lights.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, fluorescent lights themselves are one that is at 60 hertz. That's twice the rate that your eyes see at naturally. Yep. Your eyes are naturally between like 24 and 30 frames per second, basically, which is why animation, movies, things like that were originally made at that frame rate, because it's right where our eyes see, you know? But what's interesting is that's also what made the boob tube in the idiot box get that name, was the fact that it flickered at the same rate that your eyes saw. So yeah, you would eventually fall into a stupefied state of 30 hertz, you know, and 60 hertz makes you go into that twice as fast. So welcome to HD programming, folks. That stupefied hypnotic zombie-like state comes even faster in HD world with 60 hertz refresh rate and 120 hertz refresh rate. You know, it's pretty interesting when you get into that. And when you start looking at the fact of especially the effects of a lot of what our content does to us. You and I have had the conversation the last many times you've been on about the study from the National Institute of Health, talking about the effects of negative news cycles.
Oh yeah,
on the hippocampus.
Yeah,
even the effects of not only the COVID virus but the COVID vaccine on the hippocampus.
Yeah,
so when you talk about that triple whammy of negative news cycles, like we were all shoved away for 2 years, just with negative news cycles shoved in our face every day on mobile devices, on the internet, everywhere else. And at the same time, the illness you could get or the vaccine that you took for the illness, both did hippocampal damage, you know? So it's interesting to see that. And when you start looking at the, here we go. There's the one about hippocampal neurogenesis from this COVID-19 vaccination. And hey, look at that. PubMed Central, that is the National Institute of Health, folks. So That's actual scientific data. I'd love to say it's not.
And just for your viewers and your listeners, the reason it's so important to protect your hippocampal area in the brain is that's where your ability to form memories and form memories that set as your basis of how you respond to future threats actually occurs.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you want to control someone mentally, you control their hippocampus. And you can make them where they're lackadaisical towards future fears that they shouldn't be lackadaisical against, or have high anxiety against fears that they shouldn't be fearful of. For those who are guessing,
fears.
Oh yeah, the spike protein in both the natural or the unnatural virus, whether you got the virus as a disease or whether you got the spike protein as a vaccine, it's the spike protein that appears to have been specifically invented or created to be able to pass the blood brain barrier and get to the hippocampus. So that was not an accident.
Yeah, precisely. And where that controls those fears and everything else, the amygdala right there is basically what kicks in whenever the hippocampus starts going to work. And that's your source of reptilian brain, fight or flight, panic, anxiety. Everything else is your amygdala. So when you start damaging the hippocampus, you're basically widening the keyhole to access to the amygdala.
Well, and based on its function in memory, there are some physicians doing studies currently to see if the incidence of dementia is going to increase. It's been increasing over years as it is, that if it's going to increase exponentially among people who got the vaccine.
Yeah. Yeah. all of these things, when you talk about quote targeting technologies, that's what this is. These are technologies that still target us, you know. I mean, no different than a targeted ad. Literally, most of those are AI driven. They already know what you purchased, when you purchased it, and how you like to purchase. And it is disturbing how accurate those are. Like, it doesn't even need access to your microphone to be able to serve up an ad that targets you and makes you want to buy, like literally hits that part in your brain that is the dopamine and serotonin center and says, give me a hit, you know?
To go back to COVID just for one second, by the way, they finally did change the governmental COVID website to say that this was indeed, you know, in their mind, a released, you know, accidental release possibly from the Wuhan lab, you know, which we had kind of, I mean, when I first came on your show and we had many muted
parts of episodes.
Yeah.
And some of those episodes were banned in different parts of the world because of the things that we said, all that came to pass, every bit of it came to pass.
Well, and that's why I said from the beginning, I think, you know, yes, there were fatalities from COVID,
yes,
but for the most part, it wasn't the most fatal virus you could actually disseminate. But I think what COVID was fatal enough that it had people clamoring for a vaccine, and it had enough people dying that data got back to the people who actually created it, which was their goal. It was a beta test to see how quickly you could disseminate a partially deadly virus globally, and they've got that information now. So, you know, when the time comes where they actually want to disseminate something that is going to kill half of us, they've got it down.
Well,
so the reason it had to be semi-fatal was if there was no fatality, there would have been no reporting.
There also would have been no mass pan. Once again, the idea that these things all kind of triumvirately amongst the three of them, the vaccine, the virus, and the news cycle, all affected the brain in the same way, every one of them. So either way, you're getting two out of the three. You're going to be getting the negative news, because it's not like I mean, you'd have to live somewhere rural, somewhere, and there are plenty of places in the world rural that have no internet, things like that, have no mobile devices for you to be looking at negative news cycle all day long. But those of us who live in this part of the world, who live in the West, who live in other parts of the world that do have access to the news, that do have access to the internet, there was that elongated period of time where it was not happy news. It was, I mean, the closest thing you got to happy news was maybe somebody playing some music on Facebook, you know, for a long, long time. And when you marry that with, once again, just the interior panic, we're getting ready to have somebody come on the show, to talk about the way that works. You know, even the idea that PTSD can be epigenetically passed down to the next generation is a phenomenal study. And when you think about that impact upon everybody coming up, it's pretty massive. It's pretty massive. And once again, a means by which to target should they want to use it. You know, like, and it was even revealed a while back. I'll bring up the article. One of the first people to leave that Wuhan lab was France when they started building the lab, when the UN first got the funding and everything else. And right as we turned over our gain of function technology to them through our funding of the Wuhan lab, France was like, we're out of here. Like, I don't know if you know what these guys are doing, but on the way out, we're going to light a fire and let you know, like, they're trying to build ethno-specific viruses over here. Just letting you know, we're out of this. We want nothing at all to do with it.
Well, then they tried to blame it on somebody eating bat soup in the wet market. And then they tried to blame it on pangolins, which there's not enough pangolins left. I mean, those things are just about endangered from them eating them as it is, you know, so... that's why I mean, early on when I was on your show, I went, let's see, one species of bat from one particular cave in southwestern China, you know, was taken to the Wuhan lab and experimented on partially with our money with gain of function testing. And now that virus that would have never occurred in nature is attacking everybody globally, but they're going to say it's natural. And I'm like,
yeah,
you know, none of us that were physicians were buying it. And none of us that were physicians were buying that mRNA vaccine either. There's never been a vaccine created with mRNA that's worked, not one. So for the government to tell us that you could take the vaccine and you weren't getting it, and that's exactly what they said, take the vaccine and you won't get COVID, is simply not true. It wasn't true then. It's not true now. I don't care how many boosters you get. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I took the vaccine and the boosters because I worked medical conferences. I worked technology conferences. It was one of those. I was not getting into those conferences without a card. It wasn't
same happening. With us physicians. You had to have a card to keep your privileges. So now I will say I did the Johnson & Johnson, you know, which. Which is a dead virus vaccine. It's not an mRNA vaccine. I felt a little safer with that. Now, it also had, you know, some of the symptoms of, you know, clotting and things like that, you know, pericardial inflammation, but so did the mRNA one. So luckily I didn't get any of that. And I wound up getting COVID twice, you know, anyway. So
yeah, I've gotten wood right here. Not me. My wife and my kid twice, both each. Yeah. You know, but it's never hit me. And that's just it. It's one of those, like, with proper measures, things like that, I would have taken my odds all day without the virus, without the vaccine, because it only spread to a certain percentage of people to begin with. And beyond that, only 1% of those people died from it. So your chances were pretty favorable to not, you know? And even the idea that, once again, that a technology like this could be used as a vehicle for such things. Not beyond reason. Not when you're talking nanotechnology. Not when you're talking things like that. So
yeah, well, and we know that they're working on viruses that attack specific cultures and genetic profiles. So you know, for those of you who don't believe that or know it, that is an absolute truth. And I know our government and our intelligence agencies are afraid of that and probably working on it themselves too. But they are working on viruses that are genetically altered to specifically target Asian or target Black or target Caucasian or, you know, or you know, target certain gene sequences. So, I mean, it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And there it is actually out of South China Morning News. talking about genetic weapons, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, with technologies like CRISPR, things like that becoming more and more available, it's a reality. It's a real thing and a real thing to consider. It is no longer even nanotechnology, is getting more and more accessible as far as things like that go. Genetic technology has been pretty accessible for a while now.
They've kind of brought back a dire wolf or a hybridized version of it. And maybe they're actually that same company is helping Russia with the woolly mammoth and Australians with the thylacine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a Tasmanian tiger, you know, living well,
and, that and we'll see. We just did a whole episode on that. Now, that is one of those situations where, unfortunately, the dire wolf and the gray wolf are two actual different species. So,
yeah.
There was a scientist from the Watson and Crick Institute who was like, you know, we're 22 genetic combinations away from a chimpanzee. Just because you make those changes in a chimpanzee embryo and raise it does not make it a human.
Yeah.
It would still be a chimpanzee, just a designer chimpanzee with those changes in it. You know, much like if you have beautiful husky dogs and you want the next generation of them to have bluer eyes, you could definitely go to somebody and have them geneticize your dog. I mean, heck, right now, Barbara Streisand is living with a clone of her dog. And I want to say has a few in backup just in case that something happens to that one, because we know the history of clones being great are not, is not great.
Yeah.
But those things are becoming more and more common, you know, and even when you're looking at RF technologies, that kind of stuff, it's more and more common and more and more available. So even the idea that somebody, once again, private eyes, to bring this back to where we were a while ago, to think that private eyes in localized areas have access to this, what would bring the government to put that access in their hands, John?
Well, my template is the group that we discovered here.
Yeah.
Now this isn't, you know, just a bunch of civilian guys who, you know, took a private investigative course and got licensed by the state. You know, these are private investigative companies that are owned by former FBI, former NSA, former CIA officials. So they're owned by people, at least one person in the group that has a clearance, because you need a clearance to have the access to the technology. Now, I know the group here was actually giving their street agents, you know, that the head FBI guy kind of ran the company. He was the one with the clearance, and his son had a clearance. Now, they hired, you know, kind of the heavies that worked the stalking part of it, the breaking and entering and all of that. And he actually gave them fake FBI insignia, you know, so they had badges and cards, and they would try to tell the neighbors that they're, you know, hi, we're FBI, you know, we're watching this person, because eventually the neighbors do come out and say, hey, you know, why are you sitting out in front of this person's house? Well, in the state of Texas, as long as you're not on the property, you can be on the public street in front of someone's house as long as you want.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you can hang out on a public easement all day.
Yep. Yep. So eventually you walk out and you ask them, and you would get, you know, flash this FBI badge, and they'll usually, you know, in most cases with targeted individuals, will say, well, we're watching this person because they're a human trafficker, or they're a pedophile, they're a drug dealer. You know, well, then your neighbors, that it kind of enlists the help of the neighbors, because then they'll be like, well, you know, just leave them alone and don't go over there and talk to them, because did you know that so-and-so over there is a drug dealer, you know?
Yeah.
Because most people aren't going to call the FBI office, the field office, and say, hey, I got a guy out here flashing a badge with the name of such and such. Is he really FBI? Most people aren't going to take the time to do that. They're pretty trusting when it comes to law enforcement. So right or wrong, but you know, that is what we found to be the case.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, how it seems to be mostly being done. Now, that's not the case in true whistleblowers, who I've met with quite a few, that it is the Naval Investigative Service targeting their own, or the CIA targeting their own. I've met with whistleblowers from the National Reconnaissance Office, who actually controls the satellites that a lot of this technology comes from.
So, oh, wow.
Same thing. Now, when it's a whistleblower, it usually is the specific agency that's doing the targeting.
And you know, when it comes to a whistleblower, when it comes to somebody like that, that's getting ready to disrupt a system, I can fully understand that. When it comes to some of the people that have contacted me, that have contacted you, that you have sent to me for help with binaural beats, things like that. That is frequently not the case with them. You know,
we're
talking, and frequently it's the case of, like, grandpa didn't even serve in the service. You know, mom, dad didn't even serve in the service. So why target this random person? Or why target somebody that's 17, 19 years old? That kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, you've got to, like I said, at its core, it's experimental.
Yeah.
So you've got to target as many people as you can to make sure it's going to work on the majority of the general population. You know, with any technology, there's going to be people who are semi-resistant or completely resistant to it.
Yeah.
And there are, you know, people that they're targeted, they're attacked with these weapons, they're hearing voices, and they can ignore it and go about their lives. Now, we all kind of thought when Havana Syndrome broke out that there would maybe be an admission of this technology by our government, which would actually, you know, kind of propel us to get to the bottom of it. But I can tell you, one of the victims from China is a former CIA agent, anti-Trump, you know, thought the Biden administration and the CIA was going to take care of him. He was referred to the lawyer of choice for whistleblowers named Mark Zaid, that everybody that's a whistleblower ultimately gets sent to. That's where whistleblowers go to be silenced, I believe. His big thing was that before he was even allowed, along with a bunch of other victims of Havana Syndrome, were allowed to be seen at Walter Reed, they were forced to take a survey and a week's worth of evaluation through the National Institutes of Health. We're actually kind of experimented on first by our government to determine if they, you know, were going to be allowed to see a doctor at Walter Reed, which was, you know, his biggest beef with our government, kind of ignoring, you know, the health needs of the victims.
Yeah.
Now, like I said, there's about 1,500 Havana Syndrome victims. And they've put out the Defense Health Agency has put out an Article 244 that's a form that they trained military doctors and government doctors on how to treat acute Havana Syndrome, which they now call anomalous health incidents, or how to evaluate acute AHI. Mm. But they didn't send that, any of those educational materials, out to civilian doctors. So that kind of lends itself to a guilty conscience on the part of the agencies that know exactly what this is, that they're willing to give government doctors the diagnostic criteria in this DHA Article 244 document, but they're not sharing that with civilian doctors under the assumption that no civilians are going to be targeted, only government agents are going to be targeted. So in my mind, that's kind of a backhanded admission of guilt.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, I've got the article right now up from Futurism about China's new weapon, a sonic gun that vibrates your brain. This was 2019, this article came out. So that was right up around the same time, as when the Havana Syndrome stuff started, you know, it's interesting to see, like you said earlier, it would be hard for them to say the technology doesn't exist or that they don't have it if the Russians have it and the Chinese have it.
Yeah.
You know, like yeah, publicly and have it.
And that's why I think there's still especially some of the CIA assets that were targeted and victimized as Havana Syndrome victims. I think they're still playing along with it's Russia story, just maybe to get health care and to continue being evaluated. But I think most of them have figured out that it's not Russia that was targeting them, you know, from the get-go. So I think it's just another form of the experimentation on their own, because there were people in DC and it's across the spectrum. It's not targeting the targeting wasn't singling out one political persuasion within these government employees or another. I mean, personally, one of the CIA agents probably is a Democrat. So, you know, he's been anti-Trump from the start, but has came out publicly saying that, you know, he's placing a lot of hope in the Trump administration to actually get to the bottom of this because the Biden administration didn't. So,
yeah. Well, and, you know, a lot of the traction on Havana Syndrome, everything else was gained during the first Trump administration.
Yeah.
That's when the Havana Syndrome stuff started going through to begin with, everything else. So, I have said since Trump's first administration, the idea that he was dark horse, he had a donor past, but he didn't have like a political voting past. It's not like, you know, you could metric out how he would vote about going to war, because he had never voted on that as a senator, as a congressman, anything like that, you know. So when it came to topics like this, when it came to how he's going to treat alphabet agencies, how he's going to, if he will kowtow to them or not, is still yet to be shown. Because once again, he's not that kind of politician. He's not a career politician. He's not somebody whose political career would ride on such a thing, you know, where it's like, I'm going to destroy 30 years of good reputation in that right.
Yeah. Well, and he won't be running for another term. Yeah. So, you know, that in his personality, I don't think he, you know, necessarily cares what the aftermath is to the Republican Party. I think he cares what the aftermath is to the country. And I have talked to some people within the administration about this. And I think we're going to be heading in a correct direction, in kind of getting to the bottom of some of it. And honestly, I can say that I think some of the people within the cabinet are afraid of being targeted by this technology themselves. So I think we're going to be in a better off direction. I've long thought that we were talking about off camera that right now, I think the Democratic Party is the political wing of the CIA. So, I mean, there's certainly people in the Republican Party as well, especially some of the entrenched Republicans that are going to do whatever the intelligence agencies tell them to do too. But the one good thing with Trump at the helm is, you know, if there's a way to get back at the intelligence community, maybe get them back under some oversight, having somebody that's a dark horse candidate like him would be the person to do it.
Well, and that's just it, you know, and that's why a lot of people in the disclosure community hold hope. is because, once again, he is not entrenched in that system for almost a lifetime and career wise, you know. So that vested interest to follow the norm when it comes to what information is compartmentalized in that way. He doesn't have that vested interest, and that's very interesting. And I think it bodes well in a lot of ways for a lot of these things. You know, I mean, well, heck, go ahead.
One thing that some of your targeted audience will find interesting is, so I did jump through enough hoops to finally get a hold of the Defense Health Agency Document 244. And this is it's probably 30 or 40 pages of basically directions to defense physicians on how to evaluate acute anonymous health incidents. Now, one thing I can tell you is that nowhere in those directions is an RF scan or MRIs looking for implantation. Not once in any of that, any of those directions are looking for implants or looking for radio frequency waves coming out of the or into the patient, which I thought was odd. Now, one thing that I would like to see, if the government could actually open up the investigation into Havana syndrome to the general public, not just people that were working for the government.
Yeah,
I think that way you could rope in a lot of the civilian complaints. Now, it'll be overwhelming, but if we could get a group of not only the governmental agency people, but non-governmental people that are complaining of this, and get them in for diffusion tensor imaging studies, which is how they found the white track matter damage in the Havana syndrome, I think it'll be overwhelming proof that this has been going on in the civilian community a lot longer than they discovered Havana syndrome.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And once again, these things have been talked about amongst communities, amongst TI communities, for a good 30 years. So the technology to do so, to remote EEG somebody, and heterodyne that has been around for a long time. I mean, once again, the idea of binaural beats, which would be an integral part of that, basically. You know,
and I want to give you a shout out right there, Chris, because I've sent quite a few people. One thing we did find out is maybe won't make it go away completely. Certainly won't make the stalking go away. But if you're hearing voices and you're suffering from neurologic symptoms from targeting, one thing that does help is getting your brain back into synchrony. And the way we do that is by using binaural beats. What I like to do is use binaural beats through bone conduction headsets. That way we bypass, you know, the external auditory canal and go straight to the cochlea. By using binaural beats, each hemisphere will entrain that beat, and you will synchronize both hemispheres together, so you're no longer creating an interference pathway that transmits out of the brain. Not only will that inhibit their ability to track you, but it actually makes life more tolerable and kind of starts to blank out their ability to mess with you, because it blocks their ability to track you. And I just want to give a shout out to Chris, because Chris is the person that I have developing these binaural beats, because he was kind of already doing it experimentally. And, you know, when we found out that was one way to stabilize some of the people that are being targeted, he jumped in there and was more than willing to help quite a few people that I've sent to him that are using that technique to try to escape the targeting. And I just wanted to give you a big shout out and a big thank you from the community for that.
Absolutely, man. It's something that, once again, there are two main causes that this show is behind, and that is targeted individuals and human trafficking. I would have you and Billy Joe Kane on alternating every week if possible talk about these things because it needs to be shouted from the mountaintops. People need to understand that it's going on. People need to understand that it, much like abduction situations, anything like that, that it is a real thing. It exists.
Well, and human trafficking and targeting are twin siblings. Yeah. I mean, they are essentially one and the same. There's a lot of people that are victims of human trafficking that are targets. And the case that I wrote about in my first book essentially turned out they were controlling her to be a victim of rape. So, I mean, it was sexual trafficking at its best because, you know, the person has no memory of it once they're doped up with Rohypnol, and then they can control you to actually drink or eat where the Rohypnol is. So, I mean, it is the perfect human and sexual trafficking case.
Yeah, absolutely. And horrifyingly so. Doctor, thank you so much for your time as always. It's always great talking with you, catching up, things like that. Before we let you go, let everybody know where they can go to get their copy of A New Breed, Satellite Terrorism in America, as well as Guinea Pigs, Technologies of Control.
Both books, if there's a Barnes & Noble's online still around you, that they have them or can order them. And Amazon, when they have them in stock, you can get them there too. They go pretty quick, believe it or not. And I am still working diligently on my fourth book, The Fourth Branch, which we'll hopefully have out, I'm hoping, this year. So,
absolutely. Well, thank you so much, as always, for your time. I greatly appreciate it. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience.
Thank you, Chris.
Absolutely. While you are online checking out all of Dr. John Hall's amazing work over at Amazon, don't forget, you can buy all of the books from our guests, as well as videos, music, classes, all kinds of things, right over at CuriousRealm.com/store. That is our online store. All of the money goes to support Curious Research, which is our endeavor to build bridges within the research communities. And of course, you can find out more about that at CuriousResearch.org and get your copy of the Field Observation and Encounter Log if you are a researcher in the world of paranormal, UFO, UAP, cryptozoology. The Field Observation and Encounter Log is your back pocket data log to gather all of your data together in the field as it happens in real time so that you have the best quality data to shake hands with science come the day that you need to do so. Thank you so much, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.